Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that cuts through the noise and gets straight to the heart of what's truly important in the news. I'm Lee Graham, your guide for today's deep dive.
And I'm Sam Hurst, ready to help us connect the dots and explore the underlying currents of our complex world.
Today, we're doing a comprehensive deep dive into the Washington Post for Sunday, August 31st, 2025. Our mission, as always, is to go beyond the headlines, extracting those crucial nuggets of knowledge and surprising facts that help us make sense of it all. We've got a dynamic array of topics ahead of us, from major political shifts and global conflicts to deep dives into culture and the human experience. So settle in, because we're about to jump into a fascinating conversation that will leave you truly well-informed. All right, let's start with a major legal showdown that could significantly alter the current administration's approach to trade. We're looking at headlines like Trump's go-to tool at risk in court loss and ruling on tariffs tees up likely Supreme Court fight. This sounds like a pretty big deal for presidential power.
Oh, it absolutely is. This federal appeals court ruling, handed down late Friday with a significant 7-4 majority, fundamentally challenges President Trump's ability to use emergency economic powers to impose broad import taxes. The court's rationale is quite clear. They argue that the power to impose such tariffs rests squarely with Congress or existing trade imbalance frameworks, not, you know, with the president's emergency authority. It's a direct check on executive power.
Right. And the president's reaction was swift and, well, characteristic. He immediately called the court highly partisan on social media. It's worth noting the panel included 8 judges appointed by Democratic presidents and 3 by Republicans, which certainly fueled that narrative. What's the practical impact of this decision right now? Does it halt all tariffs?
Not entirely. What's crucial to understand is that this decision will not affect existing tariffs on specific industries like steel, aluminum, copper, or autos. Those were imposed under a different law. However, it will block the more sweeping country-by-country import taxes that have become, well, a hallmark of the Trump administration's trade strategy. It effectively draws a line, restricting the executive's unilateral power in this specific area.
This highlights a significant shift in the administration's legal strategy in Trump's second term. The article notes that while he tested legal limits in his first, he's now surrounded by deputies who execute and accelerate his instincts and are willing to drudge up arcane laws. A CODIS from the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity suggests the philosophy is now, let's have more expansive interpretation and let the courts decide. What does that willingness to push legal boundaries tell you about the current political climate?
Well, it's particularly striking that this isn't just a one-off legal battle. It reflects a broader strategy of continually testing the limits of executive power and daring the judiciary to intervene. Roy actually connects this to a Supreme Court decision last year that curtailed federal agency power, which served as a framework for this appeals court ruling. It suggests an administration confident in navigating or maybe even leveraging judicial challenges to redefine existing laws. For now, existing tariffs remain in effect, pending appeal. But the Justice Department, led by Attorney General Pam Bondi, plans to appeal directly to the Supreme Court.
Okay. What if the Supreme Court upholds this decision? Are there other ways the administration could impose tariffs?
They could potentially fall back on the 1974 Trade Act. However, that law comes with significant restrictions, limiting tariffs to 15% and for a duration of only 150 days, unless Congress extends them. This is a far cry from the sweeping, open-ended powers the administration has been exercising, and it would necessitate a very different, much more constrained approach to trade policy.
So this is a direct challenge to the separation of powers. How does a decision like this reinforce traditional checks and balances on presidential authority, especially concerning taxation and trade, which are typically powers reserved for Congress?
Well, this is a fundamental affirmation of Congress's constitutional role in controlling the nation's purse strings and trade policy. It's a reminder that even in times of declared emergency, there are limits to executive discretion, and that the legislative branch retains significant authority. It's a clear check on what could be seen as an overreach of presidential power. When high-level legal battles like this unfold, they directly impact the prices you pay for imported goods, the availability of products, and the stability of global markets. A shifting tariff policy, for instance, can make your everyday purchases more expensive or harder to find.
That's a crucial insight. Now let's connect this to a broader theme of how President Trump is fundamentally reshaping conservative ideology and why he appears to be wielding even greater power in his second term. This is explored in articles like Trump Redefines Conservatism, Setting Up a Fight Over Its Future, and Why is Trump So Much More Powerful This Time? This isn't just about policy, is it? It's about the very identity of a major political movement.
Indeed, it's a dramatic redefinition, almost a revolution within the conservative movement. We're seeing a clear abandonment of what used to be considered core free market principles. For example, the president has imposed tariffs of 25% or more on iPhones unless they're manufactured in the U.S., a move that could significantly inflate their price. This led Apple CEO Tim Cook to announce a $600 billion U.S. investment, securing an exemption from a 100% chip charge. Then there's the story of Coca-Cola launching a U.S. cane sugar version after a Truth Social post from Trump. These are direct interventions in private enterprise that challenge traditional conservative notions of limited government.
But it goes beyond tariffs, doesn't it? The federal government is even converting billions in funds into a 10% stake in Intel, making it one of the largest shareholders, right after Trump called for the CEO's resignation over an unsubstantiated conflict claim. What were the reactions to that?
It's particularly striking how this scrambles traditional political alignments. Senator Rand Paul, a traditional Republican, questioned if owning Intel was a step toward socialism. Yet Senator Bernie Sanders, a self-proclaimed Democratic socialist, actually hailed the move, arguing against corporate welfare without getting anything in return. This shows a willingness to demand a direct cut from businesses, with Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick even naming Lockheed Martin as a future target for similar ownership positions.
Wow, really? Lockheed. So on one hand, a push for greater executive power in trade, and on the other, a redefinition of conservative economic policy. Let's talk about the increased power in his second term. The article compares it to his first, noting that previously, firing an FBI director sparked intense blowback. Now it's a different story.
Yes, the expansion of executive power domestically is quite significant. We've seen the National Guard deployed in Los Angeles for milder civil unrest, and in D.C. for generalized concern about crime, and even litter. The Pentagon is reportedly preparing specialized guard units for civil unrest, and the idea of sending troops to Chicago and San Francisco has been floated with very little public attention. This marks a dramatic expansion of executive deployment of military force domestically, even in a time of relative civil peace.
The article offers four partial explanations for this dramatic increase in presidential power. Let's delve into what's driving this shift.
Well, the first point suggests that the Democrats are grasping for a raison d'etre. After years of delegitimizing Trump's first election, those arguments are no longer available, making it harder to contest his claims as a tribune of the people. Having emphasized democracy for so long, they struggle to object to what's presented as the undiluted will of the popularly elected president. This leaves them without a clear, mobilizing counter-narrative.
And within the Republican Party itself, there's been a transformation.
Yes. The second explanation describes a genuine revolution within the Republican Party. Two-thirds of the current GOP House caucus was elected in 2016 or later, meaning they are more aligned with Trump's vision. Independent senators have retired, and the executive branch is now staffed with highly loyal, battle-hardened individuals. This revolutionized GOP provides far less internal resistance than Trump faced in 2017.
Then there's the interregnum, the period he was out of power. How did that play a role?
It's particularly striking that the barrage of prosecutions against Trump during his time out of power likely made his second presidency more willful and vindictive. Arguments for forbearance within the White House and Justice Department have less traction when MAGAI supporters point to Democratic attempts to convict him of serious crimes. The failure of these prosecutions, in turn, likely contributes to Democratic demoralization, making them less effective in opposition.
And finally, the courts. We just discussed a court ruling that curbed his tariff power, but the article suggests the courts also play a role in his increased power.
Well, while the appeals court did curb his tariff power, the administration's willingness to continually push legal limits to drudge up arcane laws is a defining characteristic. The courts are now continually engaged in defining the scope of executive power, which in a way allows the administration to actively shape the legal landscape by challenging it. These dramatic shifts affect not just high-level policy, but the fundamental principles of governance and the balance of power. They are shaping the economic and political landscape you live in, from the price of consumer goods to the very nature of presidential authority and democratic norms.
That's a profound takeaway. From the broad strokes of politics to a more personal issue impacting every American public health, articles titled Tumult at CDC May Bode Ill for U.S. Health and On Vaccine Policy, The Worst Is Yet to Come detail widespread upheaval at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This sounds incredibly serious.
Oh, it is deeply concerning. This week saw senior officials resigning from the CDC, openly revolting against efforts to upend U.S. vaccine policy. Public health historian Alan M. Brandt called it radically unprecedented for an advanced country's health agency to be under assault from the government itself. This isn't just about policy disagreement. It's about the very integrity and independence of a scientific institution, which traditionally tracks chronic disease, investigates outbreaks, and conducts public education without fierce political debate.
Right. The article points out that the CDC's traditional work was seldom a subject of fierce political debate before the coronavirus pandemic. What changed?
Well, the coronavirus pandemic truly politicized the agency. Republicans criticized CDC guidance, and the anti-vaccine movement gained significant traction, casting doubt on other crucial shots. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a vocal critic of the CDC, now ironically oversees the agency as Health and Human Services Secretary.
Yeah.
His appointment alone signaled a new, controversial direction.
And what has this meant for the CDC in Trump's second term?
The administration has blocked CDC public communications, purged diversity and gender topics from its websites, leading to hundreds of employees being lost and key offices shuttered. To add to the tumult, there was a gunman attack on the Atlanta headquarters on August 8th. This week, the agency's director, Susan Monterez, a longtime federal scientist whom Trump nominated after his first choice lacked votes, was fired after resisting pressure from Kennedy to change vaccine policy and fire senior staff. Her attorneys released a statement saying she refused to rubber stamp unscientific, reckless directives, end quote. In June, Kennedy had already purged the CDC committee that recommends immunizations, replacing members with critics of longstanding recommendations.
So it's not just about what has happened, but what's anticipated to happen next, especially with vaccine policy.
Precisely. The FDA announced major restrictions to the coronavirus vaccine, now limiting it to adults 65 and older and younger people with specific conditions, a move seen as an opening salvo. The advisory committee is scheduled to vote next month on 2025-26 coronavirus vaccine recommendations. What's particularly striking is that two usual safeguards, career staff data analysis and the director's final authority, are now gone.
And the article warns that childhood vaccines could be next on the chopping block.
This raises serious concerns about the potential for a public health crisis. The committee is reportedly considering pulling hepatitis B, measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella, the MMRV vaccine, from the standard schedule. Kennedy has hinted at a major announcement linking certain interventions, vaccines, to autism, a link that has been thoroughly debunked by science. Furthermore, David Geyer, a discredited vaccine skeptic, has been hired to lead a federal government study on the topic, suggesting the outcome may be predetermined. The erosion of public trust in a scientific agency, particularly one responsible for safeguarding health, has profound implications. If the federal government uses its authority to curtail access to vaccines and spread misinformation, it becomes incredibly challenging for medical organizations and state and local health officials to counter it. The potential resurgence of preventable diseases could have severe public health consequences. These changes could directly impact your family's health and the health of the broader community. Understanding the sources of your health information and critically evaluating it becomes more important than ever when a scientific agency faces such politicization.
A truly vital point. Our next deep dive takes us south of the border into a harsh reality that starkly contrasts with celebratory images. Articles like a Mexican city whose people are disappearing and the World Cup city where young people are mysteriously disappearing focus on Guadalajara, a city slated to host the World Cup next year. This sounds like a deeply troubling situation.
Oh, it's a truly harrowing story, revealing the devastating human cost of organized crime. Guadalajara, despite its upcoming role as a World Cup city, lies deep within a cartel stronghold. The article opens with the personal story of Carmen Lucia Carrillo, whose son Daniel disappeared. Her search led her to a group called Guerreros Buscadores, a searching warriors, and eventually to the Isaguerra Ranch, a cartel camp, where she recognized Daniel's jeans, boxer shorts, and wallet from photos.
And this isn't an isolated incident. The United Nations has investigated this.
That's right. The UN Committee on Enforced Disappearances concluded a years-long investigation, finding well-founded information of widespread or systemic disappearances in Mexico, and asked for the government's response. The Mexican government, however, denies carrying out these disappearances, instead blaming organized crime. Jalisco authorities cite their diligence in updating crime data and their efforts, like a new ministry, drone usage, and warning campaigns for youth as evidence of their commitment.
But the cartel's penetration into local government seems incredibly deep.
It's particularly striking how deep the alleged complicity goes. The mayor of Tuchitlan, Jose Ascension Murguia Santiago, was jailed for allegedly providing police support and weapons to a cartel camp for $3,500 a month. Three former police officers have also been accused, and over 300 government employees in Jalisco have been investigated in connection with disappearances over the past 7 years. This highlights the systemic nature of the problem, where lines between state and cartel power blur.
Why are so many people disappearing? Is there a common thread?
Well, people disappear for various reasons. Involvement in drug trafficking, aggravating a cartel boss, witnessing crimes, or even by mistake. Daniel's case, for instance, fit the profile of forced recruitment. Young, muscular men are targeted, and kidnappers reportedly receive bonuses for those they bring in. Sociologist Jorge Ramirez Plasencia and former University of Guadalajara Rector Victor Manuel Gonzalez emphasize impunity as the core problem, noting that only about 1% of crimes reported in Jalisco last year resulted in conviction. This lack of justice fuels the cycle.
The story of Carmen Lucia Carrillo is particularly poignant, with her prayer for a sign and Daniel's candle flickering brightly when all others had burned out. This is a powerful human element to an otherwise grim situation. Then we have another major development. El Mayo's guilty plea could shake Mexico to its core.
It's particularly striking how this could unravel further layers of corruption. El Mayo Zambada, a notorious Sinaloa cartel leader, striking a guilty plea deal could expose entrenched networks of complicity that reach far beyond the cartel itself, potentially reshaping the fight against corruption on both sides of the border. The circumstances of his arrest are also quite dramatic. He was reportedly lured onto a plane to the U.S. in an operation orchestrated by Joaquin Guzman Lopez, one of El Chapo's sons, which ignited a bloody internal war within the Sinaloa cartel. The deep integration of cartels into local government and law enforcement, as exemplified by Guadalajara, means any intervention is not just against isolated criminal groups, but against a deeply embedded system. This deeply personal account helps us understand the dire realities of living in cartel-dominated areas and how systemic issues of crime and corruption in neighboring countries can have regional and international ramifications.
That's a truly visceral look at the human cost of these conflicts. Next, an economic issue that's literally snarling commerce around the globe. We're looking at longtime U.S. tax rule ends, snarling commerce globally, and as tariff shock sets in, small toy makers fear for holiday stockpiles, even survival. This sounds like a perfect storm for businesses and consumers alike.
It truly is. The core issue here is the end of the de minimis tax rule. For years, this Latin phrase, meaning too small or insignificant to be considered, allowed goods under a certain value to enter the U.S. duty-free. The U.S. initially dropped it for goods from mainland China and Hong Kong in May, primarily targeting massive e-commerce sites like Shein and Temu, which had reportedly avoided billions in duties. But then in July, it was dropped on all imports, with an additional goal of stopping illicit drugs like fentanyl.
And the ripple effect has been immediate and widespread, causing global disruption, hasn't it?
Well, it's particularly striking how widespread the unintended consequences have been. The change created widespread uncertainty, as transportation carriers now have to collect taxes from merchants pre-arrival, but only about a dozen service providers are certified to do so. This led over two dozen countries, including several in Europe, Japan, and Taiwan, to suspend shipments to the U.S. Many overseas businesses have simply canceled or held deliveries. An Australian fashion brand, Sabo, for instance, is now advising customers to expect delays and price increases for duties and taxes. So if you're waiting for an international package, don't expect it overnight. Paul Robertson, a UK book dealer, found himself unable to ship the $1,000 poster to an American client because all online courier options simply timed out.
That's a huge burden, and I imagine it's going to translate directly to higher costs for consumers.
It absolutely will. Kelly Flowers from Georgia was charged 46 Disneys in duties and fees on K-pop fan art from Canada. Merchants are unlikely to simply absorb these new costs, so price increases are almost certainly coming your way.
The articles highlight a particularly vulnerable group. Small toy makers. How are they coping with this tariff shock?
For them, it's been described as an absolute bomb dropped. WS Game, a family-run business, expects an $8 to $10 million loss this year, a 30% hit to their revenue. They simply can't afford the higher levy, so they're passing costs to customers. A staggering 75% of small and 94% of mid-sized toy companies plan price increases this holiday season. This has led to an inventory crisis, with toy imports from China dropping by nearly half in May and June as companies held back orders, fearing the steep levies. We can expect significant inventory shortages for the holidays.
And beyond just financial losses and higher prices, there's a human cost.
Definitely. The Toy Association reports that 55% of midsize and 45% of small businesses have laid off or plan to lay off staff due to tariffs. Major players like Hasbro, Mattel, and Funko have all cut jobs. Jonathan Silva, CEO of WS Game, said the constant changes make planning 9 to 18 months in advance absolutely impossible. Companies are scrambling for alternatives, looking to countries like Vietnam, India, and Brazil, but the administration has recently slapped levies on those countries too. Even considering U.S. manufacturing, the prices are quite high with quality concerns, and it's a sector that's been largely absent for 50 years. The tariffs, in effect, risk not just manufacturing, but also the invention, design, research development, and marketing jobs that still exist in the U.S. This is directly about your wallet and what you can buy. From shipping your favorite international items to holiday shopping, you will feel these changes in terms of prices, product availability, and shipping times. It's a clear example of how high-level policy has very tangible everyday consequences.
That's a powerful and direct impact on all of us. Now, let's turn our attention to the nation's capital, where federal actions are colliding with local realities. We have a cluster of articles here. DC's homeless confront familiar ordeal, DC flags soar amid federal crackdown, and crime is falling. But maybe less than DC claims. This paints a picture of a city under immense pressure.
It's a complex and often heartbreaking situation. Following President Trump's declaration of a crime emergency on August 11th, federal law enforcement has intensified efforts to clear homeless encampments. 50 encampments have been cleared in recent weeks, with more action forthcoming. We hear personal stories like Joyce Bauckham, her son Jonathan, who suffers from kidney failure and needs dialysis, and their dog, Lil Mama, displaced from a church that serves as a day center. Daniel Kinnery, a 64-year-old McPherson Square resident, was arrested in 2023 for refusing to leave his encampment. These individuals often avoid shelters due to pets, multiple belongings, family needs, or a feeling that homelessness itself is being criminalized.
Right. The White House justifies these actions as cleaning up DC to make it safe for all residents and visitors, offering shelter services. How has DC Mayor Muriel E. Bowser responded?
Well, Mayor Bowser opened a new shelter near Union Station, designed for 190 adults, though it won't open until after Trump's 30-day emergency period. The city has also expanded existing shelter capacity, leading to 81 additional people entering the shelter system since the federal push began. Interestingly, DC workers and volunteers conducted a nighttime census count of unhoused people this week to better target resources, especially as the cleared encampments scatter. The city's annual point-in-time count for 2025 actually showed a 9% dip in unhoused individuals from 2024 and a 19% drop since 2020. City officials claim encampments themselves decreased from 94 to 74 between January 2023 and July 2025.
And as this federal crackdown unfolds, there's a symbolic resistance emerging with DC flags soaring.
It's particularly striking how an everyday item like a flag becomes a powerful symbol of identity and dissent. DC flag sales have soared, with hardware stores running out of stock and prices up 30%. Residents are embracing it to signal opposition to Trump's crackdown and pride in their city. Jennifer, a 39-year-old D.C. resident, expressed anger at the negative portrayal of D.C. as a hellscape. Alfredo Vasquez articulated the sentiment, saying the flag sends a message. This is our home, and we can't be silenced or forgotten. These actions, including federalizing police, immigration arrests, and National Guard deployment, have renewed calls for D.C. statehood, reminding residents that they pay federal taxes but lack voting representation in Congress.
That brings us to the question of crime data itself. President Trump called D.C.'s crime data phony, and while that was ridiculed, the article suggests there are legitimate reasons to be skeptical.
This raises important questions about data integrity and public trust. The Justice Department is conducting a criminal probe, and Congress is investigating whistleblower claims that crimes are routinely reclassified as lesser offenses by supervisors. Jeff Asher, a crime data analyst, noted a significant divergence. In 2024, the FBI reported a 9% violent crime drop, while the MTD claimed a 35% decline. The DC Police Union chairman called the 35% decline preposterous. While some divergence could be due to differing reporting methods, MPD tracking incidents, FBI tracking victims, the investigation suggests deeper issues. This is a stark look at federal power, local autonomy, and the reality of homelessness in the nation's capital. It highlights how a city balances safety with compassion and what happens when those priorities clash, underscoring how policy can have profound humanitarian consequences and ignite civic resistance.
It's a powerful lesson in how policy plays out on the ground. Next, we delve into the inner workings of government agencies, revealing a concerning trend. The article, DOJ Attorneys Reassigned to New Working Group All Resign, discusses how a particular group at the Department of Justice seems to have been designed to push out career lawyers. This sounds like a serious challenge to civil service protections.
It absolutely is. The core issue is that 6 months after being reassigned to the Sanctuary City's Enforcement Working Group, all the attorneys involved have left the Department of Justice. Five individuals familiar with the group believe it was specifically designed to frustrate and eventually force out lawyers the administration felt it could replace with people more loyal to the president. This bypasses established norms and potentially undermines the independence of career civil servants.
And what exactly were these attorneys tasked with? Was it high-level legal work related to sanctuary cities?
Well, it's particularly striking that the alleged nature of the work was so menial. Instead of engaging in high-profile litigation, members were reportedly asked to perform menial research, like Google-type searches, on sanctuary city policies. Crucially, they were told there was no need to communicate with the lawyers actually filing major lawsuits against jurisdictions like Los Angeles or New York. A DOJ spokesman declined to comment on the matter, which, you know, often speaks volumes in itself.
So this wasn't just an isolated incident, but part of a broader strategy.
This highlights a significant concern about the administration's approach to the federal workforce. It's seen as part of a wider strategy across the federal government to challenge long-standing civil service protection laws and push out long-time career employees. The article highlights that notifications of these reassignments came before Pam Bondi started as Attorney General in February, which potentially skirted a 120-day moratorium on reassignments after new Senate-confirmed leaders take office. This rule is designed to ensure fair assessment of staff, but by issuing notifications early, the administration could have bypassed that safeguard.
And the goal, it seems, was to force resignations rather than face the legal challenges of outright firing these lawyers.
Precisely. Firing career civil servants outright would likely have led to lawsuits and unwanted fanfare. This more devious plan, as one source called it, aimed for resignations. However, it's worth noting that scores of lower and mid-level staff were fired outright, leading to appeals to the Merit Systems Protections Board, a quasi-judicial agency, arguing violations of due process. The lawyers in the working group, like Robin Vergeer, accepted the reassignment, hoping to eventually return to their old jobs or simply to keep a paycheck in a tough legal market. They reportedly showed up daily, scared of being fired, even tracking their badge swipes, but were never asked for their input on litigation strategy. The loss of experienced legal talent has significant implications for the effectiveness and integrity of the Justice Department. When political loyalty is prioritized over expertise and established legal procedures, it can weaken the rule of law and impact the impartial implementation of policies. For you, the listener, understanding how these internal government dynamics and the pressure on career staff can impact the integrity and effectiveness of justice and policy implementation is crucial.
That's a stark reminder of the importance of independent civil servants. We're now turning to a deeply human story that brings the brutal realities of global conflict right into a family home. The article, Under Ukrainian Occupation, One Russian Family's Path to Survival, provides a rare account of Russian civilians during Ukraine's occupation of Kursk. This is a stark reminder that war affects everyone, not just soldiers.
This is a truly profound piece, offering a glimpse into the direct human cost of geopolitical conflict. The Loganov family, 71-year-old Antonina and 75-year-old Anatoly, were caught in the occupation of their village, Guevo, just 3 miles from the Ukrainian border, for 7 harrowing months. Their son, Vitaly, later risked everything to rescue them. The article paints a devastating picture, noting that not a single building was left standing in Guevo after Russia's campaign to recapture the territory, leaving the Loganovs to lose everything they had.
And what's particularly striking is Russia's apparent unpreparedness for this incursion.
It's particularly striking how strategically and politically significant this was. Ukraine's invasion on August 6, 2024, with thousands of troops, tanks, and NATO equipment, caught Russian border guards and raw recruits completely by surprise, blasting through fortifications. Roads to Guevo and Sudza were cut off by Ukrainian drones. This was the first foreign incursion into Russia since World War II, a huge embarrassment for Putin and a total disaster, according to a former senior Kremlin official. Adding to this, Russian media and online channels initially insisted the situation was under control, discouraging flight, leading to hundreds of Russian civilians still being unaccounted for because nobody knew the truth.
How did the Loganovs survive during those 7 months, cut off from the outside world?
Oh, it was an ordeal of unimaginable hardship. Electricity and cell phone service were out. leaving them reliant on a neighbor's radio for fragmented news. They spent most nights in their basement, and their home was completely razed on November 27th. Food became a critical problem, forcing them to rely on preserves and potatoes from their garden. A local priest distributed candles for light, and they even used a generator to secretly watch Russian state TV, hoping for liberation. They reportedly did not interact much with Ukrainian soldiers and were never mistreated, though they did witness Ukrainians looting empty properties.
And the tragedy they faced during that time is incredibly moving.
This raises important questions about the unseen suffering of civilians. Their neighbor, 73-year-old Galina, fell ill, and her medication ran out. The Loganovs took her in, moving to another basement, but Galina eventually died and was buried in her daughter's garden. Their liberation came on March 27th when Russian stormtroopers arrived, a moment Antoninus described as very emotional. Vitaly, their son, later made a daring escape, commandeering a van, driving through a devastated, mine-laden landscape, and leading his parents out on foot before they were picked up by a Russian armored vehicle.
What was the aftermath for the Loganovs? Did they find any solace or compensation?
Well, they were rehoused in a temporary dormitory in Kursk City, where leaflets promised compensation. About $940 for damage and $1,880 for complete loss of their home. But tragically, Anatoly died of a heart attack on June 30th, with Vitaly saying, "His heart just couldn't take it. All these hardships really took a toll on him." Antonina now lives alone, still waiting for a new home. This fierce Russian campaign to reclaim its territory, the article notes, went on to mirror the same scorched earth tactics used against cities in eastern Ukraine. This deeply personal account allows you to feel the human cost of large-scale geopolitical conflict, beyond headlines and political rhetoric. It forces us to confront the realities of propaganda versus lived experience and the devastating impact of war on ordinary lives.
We're moving now into the opinion section, starting with an article that looks back two decades to a transformative event never seen before. Katrina set off an education revolution, re-examines the radical education reforms in New Orleans. The article calls it a miracle. What was the situation like before Katrina?
Before Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans had one of America's worst public school systems, characterized by low expectations, dreadful teaching, incompetent officials, corruption, and crumbling infrastructure. It was truly a system that was failing generations of children.
So Katrina, as devastating as it was, created an unexpected opportunity for radical change.
It's particularly striking how disaster became a catalyst. With only 16 of 128 schools intact and a third destroyed, state legislators took an enormous gamble. They fired all 7,000 teachers, sidelined unions, invited ambitious experts, and offered parents almost total freedom in choosing schools, all backed by rigorous assessment. Over the following years, at least 50 schools were either shut down or handed over to new operators, transforming the city's public education system entirely into charter schools.
And what have the long-term results of this bold experiment been, according to the Tulane study?
Well, the Tulane University study confirms what many are calling a miracle. Douglas N. Harris, who led the research, described it as the largest, broadest, and most sustained improvement we've ever seen in a U.S. school district, with substantial improvements across the board. From test scores and parental satisfaction to college access and even reduced involvement in crime. Graduation rates, which were 18% below the national average pre-Katrina, rose nearly 20 points in the first decade and are now middle of the pack nationally, with improvements sustained and recovering sharply post-pandemic.
But these reforms weren't without controversy, especially in their implementation.
This raises important questions about the social justice and equity aspects of such radical change. Harris himself noted that the reforms were courageous, controversial, and ugly at times, imposed by the state on a majority black city in a majority white state. The share of African-American teachers fell from 71% to less than half, though it later rebounded slightly, while managers' pay soared and rehired teachers faced longer hours and lower salaries. Yet unexpected outcomes included an increase in non-white pupil enrollment in higher performing schools and a greater diversity of school options. School leader Adrian Reddick highlighted the same mission and team dynamic, emphasizing the constant pressure to deliver, stating, "We have no time to waste."
What lessons does this offer for the broader education reform debates?
Well, the Tulane report suggests important lessons for both sides of the political spectrum. It argues that the left should be less beholden to teachers' unions, and the right should be far more skeptical that vouchers alone can lift school standards, as Louisiana's embrace of vouchers actually had a negative effect on school outcomes. Even with New Orleans still grappling with urban poverty and its population below pre-Katrina levels, and Mayor LaToya Cantrell recently indicted on charges of wire fraud and obstruction, the radical school experiment offers a powerful, albeit complex, message of hope and the potential for transformational change in the face of adversity. This story explores whether radical disruption can genuinely lead to miracles in education, and what sacrifices and who makes them are involved. It invites you to consider these complex dynamics when engaging in debates about your own local school systems.
A compelling analysis. Our next article takes us to India with a disturbing account titled Stateless by Design: How India is Erasing Its Citizens. This sounds like a severe violation of human rights and a threat to democratic foundations.
Oh, this is a deeply unsettling piece, drawing chilling parallels between India's actions and historical injustices elsewhere. The core issue is India's systematic disenfranchisement of its Muslim population, which mirrors Myanmar's actions against the Rohingya. The article highlights a striking double standard. While the world spoke loudly about China's Uyghurs, often when it suited geopolitical interests, there's a relative silence surrounding India's actions. Brazilian President Lula da Silva speaks out for Gaza, but not India's Muslims. And despite the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom documenting assaults on Muslims, PM Modi was welcomed with state honors by President Biden in 2023. The message is clear. Strategic partnerships often outweigh human dignity.
So this isn't just a domestic issue. It has international implications.
Absolutely. The article points to India forcing about 40 Rohingya refugees, including children, into the sea with life jackets, telling them to swim to Myanmar, a grotesque violation of international law condemned by the UN. Internally, Muslim citizens are being branded Rohingya or Bangladeshi as a pretext for dispossession, even when they possess valid documents. This is a path, the article argues, that is similar to Myanmar's rendering of the Rohingya stateless through its 1982 citizenship law. But India is doing it without the cover of military rule. It is, after all, a democracy.
That distinction makes it even more dangerous. How is this erasure being carried out within India?
This raises important questions about the tools of authoritarianism being used within a democratic framework. In 2019, Indian citizens protested the Citizenship Amendment Act and the National Register of Citizens, which could disenfranchise an estimated 2 million people, mostly Muslims, but many activists were arrested and remained jailed. The bulldozer, once a symbol of development, is now feared by Muslim communities, with homes razed in places like Jaihan Camp and Bengali Market, and relatives disappearing after raids. These are direct physical acts of dispossession. The irony of realpolitik is starkly revealed here. When a democracy uses such tools, backed by international indifference, it sets a dangerous precedent for its own undoing and for other democracies globally. The article issues a call for unified moral opposition from supporters of democracy to prevent these evictions and deportations from spreading, emphasizing that if the world's largest democracy normalizes such behavior, others will be tempted to follow. This story helps us understand how a major democracy can systematically erode human rights, and the profound global implications of selective outrage and strategic alliances that prioritize political or economic interests over human dignity.
A sobering perspective. Next up, we're diving into the curious and frankly disturbing world of government-produced social media content. The article, Preposterous ICE Videos Have a Holy War to Sell You, reveals how the Department of Homeland Security and ICE are using highly nationalistic, Christian-themed, and dehumanizing propaganda. This sounds like something out of a dystopian novel.
It truly is. The core issue is the weaponization of imagery and religion by a government agency. The article describes an early July minute-long video featuring agents in tactical gear, eerie red light, and a helicopter set to Black Rebel Motorcycle Club's God's Gonna Cut You Down, with a quote from the Book of Isaiah. The band actually demanded a takedown for copyright violation, but the message was clear. It conjured a holy war with God's soldiers battling evil, which is implied to be undocumented immigrants, often depicted as shadows. It's particularly striking that the Isaiah quote was used wildly out of context, completely missing its original message of justice and rebuking oppressors.
And this isn't an isolated incident. It's part of a broader, more unhinged propaganda strategy.
Yeah, the article notes these are humdrum government recruitment ads, marinated with unhinged 21st century meme culture, then seasoned with a bit of Bible and Batman. We also see images of Homeland Secretary Cristiel Nayem riding a horse in Argentina. This propaganda also heavily relies on dehumanization, with countless snapshots of apprehended immigrants and criminal activities lavishly described, despite Syracuse University research showing over 70% of detainees have no criminal convictions. It implies some people belong, others do not, often targeting Latino men largely mestizo or indigenous in appearance.
They're even repurposing iconic American imagery.
It's particularly striking how they appropriate symbols. Adaptations of WWII, I Want You. Uncle Sam posters are used to recruit for rounding up day laborers, construction workers, and high school students with captions like, "America has been invaded by criminals and predators. We need you to get them out." Even a 1936 illustration by Frank Lea, "Which Way to Prosperity," was altered by DHS to read "Invasion, Homeland, and Law and Order" with the caption, "Which Way, American Man?" echoing language used by white nationalist William Gailey Simpson. When NPR queried DHS, their response was dismissive. "Calling everything you dislike Nazi propaganda is tiresome." This suggests an awareness of the dog whistle effect.
And the Christian nation aesthetics extend beyond this.
Absolutely. We see vintage illustrations of DC's neoclassical buildings with captions like, "American exceptionalism begins in the nation's capital," and even a Thomas Kincaid painting, which the Kincaid Foundation decried as unauthorized and deplorable actions. There's also the use of John Gast's 1872 American Progress painting, which celebrates manifest destiny and the displacement of indigenous people, with the caption, "A heritage to be proud of, a homeland worth defending." This imagery is also reflected in broader trends, with White House social media sharing pictures of Christian leaders praying over Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's department recruitment video featuring a Psalms verse and the caption, "We are one nation under God." This raises important ethical questions about the role of government agencies in disseminating such politically charged content. The weaponization of religious, nationalistic, and historical symbols for propaganda purposes raises serious ethical concerns. The dehumanization of entire groups of people as invaders or criminals is a dangerous path, and the use of misinformation and dog whistles through official channels helps mainstream extremist ideas. For you, the listener, this story highlights how images and language shape perception, especially in politically charged issues. It underscores the critical thinking required to navigate such content and discern the underlying messages being conveyed, often through subtle or not so subtle means.
Let's turn to an alarming incident that illustrates a stark conflict of priorities. The article, "Border Patrol Arrested Firefighters as They Battled Blaze," reports on immigration agents detaining firefighters during an active wildfire in Washington state.
This sounds unprecedented.
Oh, it absolutely is, and it's deeply troubling. The core issue is that Border Patrol agents conducted an immigration raid on an active fire scene, the Bear Gulch Fire, capturing the incident in social media videos where voices exclaimed, "We got hit by ICE." Veteran wildland firefighters could not recall a similar episode, and it raises immediate concerns about the distraction it creates for firefighters in strenuous environments. More broadly, there's a chilling effect on a workforce that relies heavily on immigrant labor, with former U.S. Forest Service Chief Dale Bosworth calling it dangerous.
What was the Border Patrol's justification for this action? Well, Chief Patrol Agent Rosario P. Vasquez stated that the agency steadfastly enforces the laws, unapologetically addresses violations wherever they are encountered. The Department of Homeland Security later clarified the Border Patrol agents arrived at the request of the Bureau of Land Management following a criminal investigation. The firefighters worked for Oregon-based contractors under the U.S. Forest Service. At the time, it was the last day for the incident management team. The fire wasn't spreading much, and about 400 firefighters were gathering equipment or even cutting firewood for residents. Immigration officials showed up at a drop point and started asking for identification.
And the reaction from public officials in the Northwest was swift and strong.
It's particularly striking how clear the conflict of priorities is between federal and state authorities. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson expressed deep concern, and Commissioner of Public Lands Dave Upthgrove described the Trump administration's approach as crude and inhumane, arguing it, quote, intentionally and unnecessarily stoke fear and mistrust among members of the public, including firefighters, putting their lives on the line to protect our state, unquote. This isn't just a legal disagreement. It's a profound ethical dilemma about immediate public safety versus immigration enforcement. The reliance on immigrant labor in dangerous and critical fields like wildland firefighting has significant implications. Many of these crews, particularly contractors, rely on immigrant labor, and actions like this can deter workers from engaging in critical public safety efforts, potentially impacting our ability to fight wildfires effectively in the future. It erodes public trust in law enforcement and can make communities less likely to cooperate, which is vital in emergency situations. This incident highlights what happens when different government mandates clash, and how it affects community safety and the people who put their lives on the line.
That's a very clear example of conflicting priorities. Our next story takes us back in time, exposing a dark chapter of corporate exploitation in Brazil. The article, "Volkswagen Brazil Liable for Slave Labor at Amazon Ranch," reports on a landmark ruling. This is a significant development, decades in the making.
It truly is a landmark case. Volkswagen Brazil has been held liable for slave labor at an Amazon ranch decades ago and ordered to pay $30 million in damages, though they've announced an appeal. This ruling has opened a window into a largely forgotten chapter of Brazilian history, when the country's former military dictatorship rapidly developed the Amazon in partnership with multinational corporations. Tens of thousands of impoverished laborers were lured to ranches, made to toil unwillingly to destroy the Amazon for cattle ranching.
This sounds like a horrific period. Were the individuals responsible ever identified?
The article mentions two recruiters, Francisco Andrade Chagas, who died in 2014, and Abilio Dias Araujo, now 82, who claimed not to remember anything. What's particularly striking here is that Volkswagen is the first company to be held liable for abuses in the Amazon during this period, and it sets an important precedent. In Brazil, the crime of reducing someone to conditions analogous to slavery has no statute of limitations, which federal prosecutor Ulysses Dias de Carvalho called a historic mark and an example for next cases.
It also highlights the crucial role of advocates in bringing these hidden histories to light.
Absolutely. Ricardo Rezende Figueira, a 73-year-old Catholic priest, spent his life meticulously documenting modern slave labor, preserving the details of what happened on the Santana do Araguaia property. His dedication ensured that this forgotten injustice was not lost to time.
And how will the $30 million in damages be distributed? Will it go directly to the former laborers?
Well, this raises important questions about justice for victims and the nature of reparations. The judge ordered the $30 million to be paid to a fund in Pará, focused on promoting dignified working conditions and eradicating slave labor in the state, rather than directly to the former laborers. While the laborers who testified expressed disappointment about not receiving direct compensation, they also conveyed relief that their ordeal had finally been recognized. This ruling is seen as a victory for human rights and an important step towards corporate accountability for historical abuses, connecting land development with exploitation and the destruction of the Amazon. This story makes us consider how corporations are held accountable for past actions and the lasting impact of historical injustices on communities and environments. It prompts us to reflect on our responsibility to understand the origins of products and the ethical implications behind them, even decades later.
We're starting this section with a story that could impact millions of Americans directly. The article, "Social Security Whistleblower Quits After Saying Data Was Compromised," highlights a massive data security concern. This sounds incredibly serious for personal privacy.
Oh, it's deeply unsettling. The core issue is that Social Security's chief data officer resigned after alleging that U.S. DOGE service staffers uploaded critical personal information for over 300 million people, names, birth dates, and other data that could be used for identity theft to a digital cloud without sufficient security controls. This wasn't an allegation of hacking, but rather a warning from the whistleblower, Borges, that this act substantially threatened the safety of Americans' information.
And the DOG services, or Department of Government Efficiency's, access to Social Security data has already been a point of contention.
It's particularly striking how this highlights the underlying tension between government efficiency and data safeguards. DOGE has been controversial since Elon Musk's group of technologists first gained access to the agency, even leading to the resignation of an acting SSA administrator in February. DOGE's goal was to search for fraud in payments and to build a single centralized database, despite concerns from government workers about such a move. Borges, who has over two decades of experience in the U.S. Navy and roles in other federal agencies, said he only learned about this massive data transfer after the fact from his own staff.
This raises important questions about whistleblower protection and public trust in government agencies.
Absolutely. The resignation of a high-ranking official like Borges, who has a long background in federal service, after raising such an alarm, underscores the importance of whistleblowers in exposing potential dangers within government agencies. The incident itself, whether or not the data was actively compromised, certainly erodes public trust in agencies responsible for our most sensitive personal information. It forces us to confront the balance between rapid modernization drives and the absolute necessity for rigorous security protocols and oversight, especially with critical infrastructure and personal data. Your personal data is at stake. How confident are you that the government is protecting your most sensitive information? This story highlights the immense implications of digital transformation without adequate safeguards and the crucial role of internal checks on powerful initiatives.
That's a critical question for every citizen. Our next piece focuses on a government agency dedicated to soft diplomacy, now facing significant internal turmoil. Kari Lake sends layoff notices to more than 500 at Voice of America, its parent agency. This sounds like a serious challenge to the agency's mission.
It absolutely is. The core issue is that Kari Lake, acting CEO of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, or USAGM, sent layoff notices to over 500 staff at Voice of America, or VOA, on a Friday night, right before the Labor Day weekend, with a termination date of September 30th. This comes amidst ongoing legal challenges for Lake, who was blocked earlier this week from firing VOA's director and faces allegations of overstepping her statutory authority.
For listeners unfamiliar with Voice of America, what is its historical role?
Well, VOA was founded by the federal government in 1942 to counter Nazi propaganda, practicing a form of soft diplomacy by broadcasting stories about democracy in countries where press freedom is limited or non-existent. It's a significant global outreach, reaching 420 million people in 63 languages and over 100 countries weekly. However, President Trump, during his first term, accused VOA of speaking for America's adversaries, not its citizens. In March, he issued an executive order aimed at chiseling the agency down to its minimum presence and function required by law.
So these layoffs are part of a broader, more sustained effort to reshape the agency.
This highlights important questions about the politicization of government agencies. Lake, a Republican politician who ran unsuccessful campaigns for Arizona governor and U.S. Senate, has been at the forefront of this effort. This led to more than 1,000 journalists being placed on indefinite administrative leave. She previously fired 500 contractors in May and attempted to fire over 600 full-time staffers in June, a move that was rescinded due to administrative errors. This pattern suggests a deliberate strategy to dismantle and reshape the agency rather than just streamline it. The broader implications are significant. When a government criticizes and seeks to dismantle its own news outlet, it sends a powerful message about press freedom both domestically and internationally. This undermines the ability of government-funded broadcasters to promote democracy and counter-propaganda credibly. Beyond the mission, there's a human cost: mass layoffs and job insecurity for hundreds of journalists and professionals who have dedicated their careers to this form of public service. This story highlights how government actions affect the media's ability to report freely, both domestically and internationally.
Now for a heartwarming story that reminds us of the profound impact of simple human connection. The article, "This Dad Writes to Strangers Who Need Father Figures," introduces us to Buzz Ecker, a retired professor offering kindness and support one letter at a time. This is a beautiful antidote to the often bleak news we cover.
It truly is. The core issue here is the deep human need for connection and mentorship, and how an individual's simple act can address it in a meaningful way. Buzz Ecker, a retired professor with a recent PhD, started this after his daughter, Rosie Pollack, posted on TikTok asking if anyone wanted a letter from her dad, who loves writing letters more than most people love their kids. Ecker finds it very gratifying to be people's fathers who don't have one.
And he's not just writing a few letters. This has become a significant undertaking for him.
It's particularly striking how much dedication and reach this endeavor has. Ecker wakes up at 4:30 a.m. and writes for about 4 hours each morning. Hundreds of people worldwide have received his letters, with requests picking up significantly after an ABC News story. Amy Woods from Chatham, England, cried reading a letter she received after her father's death anniversary, finding it a powerful reminder of her love for her dad. This demonstrates the profound impact of a personal touch in an increasingly digital and often isolating world.
What kinds of issues are people writing to him about?
Well, the common threads in the requests highlight pervasive emotional needs. People grieving loved ones, navigating difficult relationships with their own fathers, new dads feeling lost, individuals stressed from work or recovering from breakups. Ecker's letters are a blend of personal stories about his own parents, his grief, and light anecdotes about his daughter's cat or his dogs, offering a blend of empathy and gentle, relatable humanity. He grew up receiving hundreds of letters from his own mother and continued the tradition with his children, making this a deeply personal practice for him. This raises important questions about the unique value and emotional resonance of a handwritten letter in our age of instant digital communication. In an era of fleeting digital messages, a personalized handwritten letter carries immense weight and signifies a deeper investment of time and thought. It's a tangible manifestation of care. Ecker's story also serves as a wonderful example of finding fulfilling purpose in retirement, channeling his passion for writing and his compassionate spirit into helping others. This story is a beautiful reminder of the simple gestures that can make a profound difference in someone's life. It encourages us to reflect on the hidden needs and quiet acts of generosity around us, and perhaps even to consider how we might offer a similar connection to others in our own lives.
A truly inspiring story. let's turn our attention to an emerging infrastructure challenge with potentially severe consequences. The article, Texas Data Boom Haunted by Memories of Winter Blackouts, discusses how the state's rapid growth in AI data centers is straining its electrical grid. This sounds like a classic conflict between economic growth and reliable infrastructure.
Oh, it absolutely is. The core issue is that the American electrical grid is creaking under the growing demand from data centers that power AI, streaming, and other digital services. Texas, in particular, has become a major hub, hosting data centers for giants like Meta, Alphabet, and Microsoft. Abilene is the site of the Stargate AI data center project, announced by Trump, with plans for a $100 billion investment. President Trump has even made expanding data centers a national priority, easing federal permitting for construction.
But Texas has a painful history with grid reliability, especially after the 2021 winter storm.
It's particularly striking how this highlights an immediate historical lesson. The deadly 2021 winter storm, Uri, caused blackouts for millions of residents, leading to over 200 deaths, while industrial operations, including data centers, remained online. This trauma clearly informed the state's recent actions. ERCOT, the Texas grid operator, testified in 2024 that energy demand could double in just 6 years, largely due to data centers threatening grid reliability. This led to the passage of State Bill 6, an unprecedented remedy allowing power cuts to energy-guzzling facilities during emergencies, a measure explicitly aimed at avoiding another Storm Uri.
So the state is actively intervening to manage this demand, but there's also political alignment with the push for more AI infrastructure.
This raises important questions about the balance between state-level safeguards and federal priorities. Texas leaders like Governor Abbott have welcomed these projects for their tax revenue. OpenAI even lobbied state officials with former Abbott chiefs of staff. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick called ERCOT's forecast shocking, but also aligned with Trump's vision for AI dominance, acknowledging the need for growth while recognizing the strain. However, not all Republicans are on board. Vance Gin, a former Texas lobbyist, argued that such regulation could make the state less attractive to tech, potentially threatening Trump's AI dominance plans.
And what's the White House's view on this?
Well, White House spokesperson Harrison Fields stated that Trump's goal is a golden age for American technological dominance, urging state legislators and regulators to facilitate data center development in a symbiotic relationship without unreasonable and onerous restrictions. Despite the new law, more projects are in the pipeline, including a nuclear-powered facility near Amarillo named the Donald J. Trump Advanced Energy and Intelligence Campus. And OpenAI is expanding Stargate with an additional 4.5 gigawatts of power consumption. As AI and digital services become more integrated into your life, understanding the hidden infrastructure and its vulnerabilities is crucial. This story highlights the trade-offs we face for our technological future, balancing innovation and economic opportunity with public safety, environmental concerns, and grid resilience in the face of extreme weather events.
Here's a delightful and unexpected story of everyday heroism. Man in Batman onesie foils early morning burglary, nabbed suspect, police say, tells the tale of Kyle Myvett in Cape Coral, Florida. Sometimes the most memorable stories come from the most ordinary places.
This is a fantastic example of that. The core issue is an unexpected act of heroism, where 47-year-old general contractor Kyle Myvett, wearing a Batman onesie, woke up to a security alert, found a suspect had fled his driveway, and then proceeded to roam his neighborhood in his black Ram 2500 truck. He spotted, detained, and then handed the suspect over to the Cape Coral police.
And his choice of attire definitely added to the legend.
It's particularly striking how charming the detail of his attire is. My vet bought the extra-large Batman onesie in 2016 to match pajamas he'd gotten for his daughter. He calls it his uniform and wears it for a good night's sleep, though his wife reportedly threw away the mask. Even the police were impressed. Detective Michael Scarlato commented, "Good to see Batman, you know, keeping Cape Coral safe." And officers asked for a photo with him. After the whole ordeal, my vet went home, slept for 3 hours, then changed into his other uniform for his day job, joking about adding crime fighting to his company's services. This raises important questions about the nature of everyday heroism. It's a reminder that acts of courage don't always come from Cape Crusaders in the night, but often from alert citizens willing to act. It also highlights the intersection of citizen vigilance, personal security technology, and responsive law enforcement and community safety. This is a reminder that heroes can come in all forms, even in a Batman onesie, and that community safety often relies on the alertness and willingness of its residents to step up when needed.
Absolutely brilliant. Okay. We also had a mention of Ned, the lefty-shelled snail, and a viral music genre from a slum in the Philippines. Just quick hits showing creativity and connection in unexpected corners, right?
Exactly. Just brief mentions, but they fit that theme. Ned, the snail with the 1 in 40,000 left coiling shell, and the national campaign in New Zealand to find him a mate. It's whimsical, but highlights biodiversity and that universal search for connection. And the viral music genre from the Philippines. It's a reminder of cultural innovation springing from adversity and how digital platforms can amplify voices from anywhere. Little sparks of human spirit in the mix.
Kicking off our Metro section, we have a story that touches on consumer protection and housing safety. The article, District AG Sues Building Company, details legal action against a developer in Northeast Washington. This seems like a pretty clear-cut case of prioritizing profits over safety.
It does. The core issue here is that D.C. Attorney General Brian Schwalb is suing Key Homes LLC, the former owners and developers of a new 40-unit apartment building, for allegedly violating consumer protection laws. Specifically, they're accused of leasing units from late 2023, even though the property hadn't passed key safety inspections, and critical building systems like the fire alarm and sprinklers were dysfunctional.
How have the former owners responded to these serious allegations?
Well, it's particularly striking how they've mounted their defense. They largely deny the allegations, claiming it was the result of miscommunication with the city in addressing code issues. They assert that fire alarms and sprinklers were always working, and that they addressed concerns ahead of deadlines, obtaining necessary permits. They even suggested that glitches with the Department of Buildings website might have played a role in the confusion.
It sounds like a complex situation, especially given the building's current status.
Indeed. The company lost the property to foreclosure earlier this year after some tenants reportedly stopped paying rent, leading to the building's ownership transferring in July to Winsharp Capital, a firm specializing in distressed properties. This adds another layer of complexity, raising questions about ongoing accountability now that ownership has changed hands. This raises important questions about tenant safety and developer accountability. It underscores the critical importance of safety inspections, especially in new developments, and the legal recourse available to a city against companies that allegedly cut corners. The defense's claims of miscommunication and glitches also highlight potential bureaucratic challenges within city oversight, which can inadvertently contribute to serious housing issues. This is about your rights as a renter or homeowner and how the city works to protect you from unsafe living conditions.
Our next story is truly inspiring, highlighting the breaking of gender barriers in sports. She's the first female boxer in her club. She's also in middle school. This is a heartwarming account of determination.
Oh, it absolutely is. The core issue here is 13-year-old Andrea Giron, who became the first female boxer to officially fight for Big Things Boxing Academy in Virginia. She competed in her first official bout, sanctioned by USA Boxing, at Shirley C. Heim Middle School. It's a powerful story of a young athlete challenging traditional norms.
How did Andrea get into boxing, and what was her training like?
Andrea initially looked for an alternative to soccer and found her way to the Wilston Multicultural Center, where Coach Freddie Ramirez offers free training in an improvised studio. She quickly became one of a committed handful of students, undergoing rigorous training that included five-mile jogs, kettlebell weights, heel tap drills, hours of pummeling punching bags, and nearly 20 sparring sessions. Her idols include professional fighters Amanda Serrano and Canelo Alvarez. When she faced her opponent, Taylor Too Tough Hill, who arrived with a championship belt, Andrea's goal was not just to win, but to be the first female to fight for the club. This highlights important questions about breaking barriers and the role of mentorship and community. Andrea's journey is a testament to how young athletes, particularly girls, can excel in traditionally male-dominated sports with the right support. It highlights the crucial role of coaches and community centers in providing opportunities that build confidence, discipline, and a strong sense of achievement. This is a heartwarming story of determination and breaking molds. It encourages you to consider what inspires you to try something new, even against expectations, and the profound impact that dedicated mentors and supportive communities can have on young lives.
Next up, we have a climate story that highlights some dramatic and rapid shifts in local weather patterns. After downpours in June and July, August is set to be the driest in 150 years. It seems D.C. is experiencing quite the weather whiplash.
Indeed. The core issue is that D.C. is on track for its driest August in over 150 years, with only 0.2 inches of rain this month, easily beating the previous record of 0.55 inches set in 1962. It's particularly striking how abrupt this shift is. It follows near daily downpours in June and July, as if the rain faucet was suddenly turned off in early August.
So we're not just looking at a dry August, but a stark contrast to recent months.
Right. This August will also rank among the driest of any calendar month in recorded history, with only 7 months having observed less rain, including October 1963, which had no measurable rain at all. This rapid shift from extreme wet to extreme dry is a significant concern because the pesky drought that left in late June threatens to return, with much of the D.C. area already experiencing abnormally dry conditions. This highlights important questions about the tangible effects of human-caused climate change. The article explicitly states that extreme dry and wet spells, often in short succession, are a hallmark of human-caused climate change. While the Weather Service predicts near to above-average rainfall for the eastern U.S. in early September, models project only 0.25 to 1.0 inches for D.C. in the next 2 weeks, which is still less than normal. Historically, September and October are prone to prolonged dry spells, with over half of the top 10 driest months occurring in early fall. How do these dramatic weather shifts impact your daily life, local ecology, and longer-term planning for resources like water?
It's a vivid reminder that climate change isn't just a global phenomenon, but something that manifests in very real local ways.
A sad note now, remembering a true sporting legend. Ron Turcotte, who rode Secretariat to the Triple Crown, dies at 84. This marks the passing of an icon.
It really does. Ron Turcotte's achievement with Secretariat in 1973, ending that 25-year Triple Crown drought, is legendary. Secretariat's Belmont record, winning by an astonishing 31 lengths and 2.24, still stands 52 years later. Turcotte himself said, "I still had a lot of horse when I passed the wire." He won each of the Triple Crown races twice in his career, also winning the Derby and Belmont in 72 with River Ridge. He described his connection with Secretariat as love at first ride, a true legend remembered for his humility and strength. His legacy will absolutely live forever in racing.
It's a moment to reflect on those incredible sporting stories that transcend generations, isn't it? That special bond between jockey and horse, just unforgettable.
Absolutely. It reminds us of the power of those iconic moments in sports history.
All right, let's explore book world. First up, a memoir offering a glimpse behind the curtain of a fashion institution. Jean Pressman's They All Came to Barney's, reviewed under the headline, "Barney's was a temple of chic for the glitterati, now we all get a glimpse." Sounds like a dishy read.
Oh, it certainly seems to have its moments. The core issue is Jean Pressman's passionate and reportedly quite dishy account of his family's iconic New York department store. Mm. It covers its rise from Barney Pressman's 1923 opening to its transformation, largely led by Jean, into a temple of chic, a playground for adults. Mm. The store attracted incredible talent. Stephen Meisel for ads, Glenn O'Brien for copy, Simon Doonan for windows, Peter Marino for store design, not to mention models like Linda Evangelista and Sandra Bernhard.
And the clientele list reads like a who's who.
It's exactly. From John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd buying suits in the 70s to Madonna, Eyman, Warhol, Basquiat, and Keith Haring showing up for an A's fundraiser. The review mentions dishy gems about Lauren Hutton and Malcolm Forbes, allusions to debauched nights, and a detailed recollection of the era's nightlife Studio 54, Le Jardin. Jean himself was the loudest voice, pushing for the women's wear expansion, dropping the apostrophe from Barney's to Barney's in 1981, signaling that shift to meticulous New York sophistication.
But it's also framed as a cautionary tale, isn't it?
Yes, that's crucial. The family grew the business too aggressively, expanded with too much hubris, diluted the brand, and ultimately filed for bankruptcy, leaving a trail of acrimony and infighting. They sold their last shares by 2004. Barney's technically still exists as a brand at Saks, but the iconic flagship store has been vacant since 2020, soon to be converted into residential units. Despite the fall, Pressman's sincerity shines through, weaving his family story with the history of the American fashion industry.
It's a fascinating look at retail evolution, family business dynamics, and the transient nature of cultural landmarks, a real glimpse behind the glamour. Now we're diving into the world of AI again, but from a different angle. A critique of Amir Hussein's The Cybernetic Society, reviewed as "Our Bots, Ourselves, a Shallow Theory of AI and the Brain." This sounds like a strong counterpoint to unchecked techno-optimism.
It definitely is. The core issue here is the reviewer's sharp critique of Hussein's book, which argues that AI and humans are forming a special hybrid entity destined to improve the world. Hussein paints this utopian picture ending disease, producing abundance, but the reviewer finds it a scramble of futuristic fantasies that largely dismisses the profound risks and ethical complexities in favor of convenience.
So Hussein acknowledges the risks but sets them aside.
Pretty much. It's striking how he mentions the massive energy consumption, climate impact, potential for illiteracy, even psychosis among users, but then quickly pivots, suggesting AI will somehow compensate for these issues. The reviewer skewers Hussein's ideal of effortless human flourishing, suggesting it prioritizes convenience above all else, ignoring the value of difficulty and patience.
And his prime example of this future is NEOM, the Saudi Smart City Project.
Yes, Hussein praises NEOM's theoretical efficiency, the flawless grid, self-regulating rooms, AI assistants speculating it could shift demographics simply by being more livable, convenient, safe, and friendly. The review points out the complete lack of consideration for history, beauty, or even the human experience of getting lost. Hussein seems to view any opposition as merely technical or regulatory hurdles, almost suggesting we outsource political quandaries to the machines themselves.
It sounds politically blind, almost dangerously so.
The review argues exactly that. It presents Hussein's vision as one where complex societal problems are reduced to technical fixes, ignoring the deep philosophical implications of merging human identity with AI and prioritizing convenience over deeper human values. This serves as a crucial critical lens on the narrative surrounding AI. It urges us, the readers, you, the listener, to question these utopian promises and ask whether we're adequately considering the true costs, ethical, environmental, social, of effortless human flourishing.
A necessary dose of skepticism. Let's turn back the clock again, this time to the Wild West, but with a very different perspective. Peter Cawson's Deadwood, reviewed as Deadwood's Story of Mud and Blood, strips away the romance.
Yes, this review positions Cawson's book as a stark corrective to the myths. The core argument is that Deadwood embodies the dark side of American freedom, the freedom to profit at anyone's expense. It portrays the town not as a rugged frontier outpost, but as an outlaw enterprise built fundamentally on violence, theft, and greed, largely driven by the gold rush on Lakota land.
An outlaw enterprise? How so?
It was unique because it existed outside of any U.S. territory or laws initially. Its inhabitants were essentially trespassers. The review highlights Cawson's point about government complicity, suggesting President Grant actively schemed to take the Black Hills from the Lakota, provoking the Great Sioux War.
And the town itself was steeped in vice.
Absolutely. The review emphasizes the depravity, rampant drinking, gambling, prostitution. It mentions real figures like Al Swearengen and Calamity Jane, painting a picture far removed from any sanitized Hollywood version. The wealth extracted was staggering, with figures like George Hearst eventually monopolizing mining operations. While Deadwood eventually integrated into the American system with schools and churches, Cousins insists its foundation was rotten, built on the dispossession of the Lakota.
So it's fundamentally about the corrosive influence of greed.
Exactly. The review frames it as a powerful case study of America's obsession with money and its role in westward expansion, challenging us to confront the violent and exploitative origins often glossed over in traditional narratives. It forces you to rethink the mythology of the West and consider the true costs of American expansion and the pursuit of wealth.
Now, for something completely different in the sci-fi and fantasy realm, a review of Chian Rand's The Midnight Shift, mentioned as one of three delightfully strange new sci-fi and fantasy books.
Yes, this one sounds intriguing. The core themes explored are loneliness, human connection, and a rather unique take on vampires. The plot involves suicides at a rehab facility, a detective investigating, and a mysterious woman named Violet, who claims a vampire is killing lonely elderly people because, apparently, lonesome blood tastes better.
Lonesome blood tastes better. That's specific.
It is, isn't it? The review notes the book delves into the causes of loneliness, people feeling too unusual, too aware of the world's darkness, or losing childish fancies. It also features flashbacks revealing Violet's past and complex vampire politics. The style is described as simple, matter-of-fact, letting emotional turmoil build slowly before erupting, like in scenes where characters rage at fresh corpses.
It sounds like it uses the supernatural to explore very human feelings.
Precisely. The review highlights a key quote. "It's truly remarkable how the one who saves you can be the one who kills you," suggesting complex relationships and the double-edged nature of connection. It uses the fantasy framework to offer a speculative look at loneliness, a pervasive modern issue, and the unseen forces, internal or external, that might prey on our vulnerabilities. It prompts you to consider the hidden costs of isolation and the intricate, sometimes dangerous, dynamics of human relationships.
Fascinating. There's also a big fall preview article mentioning a ton of books. Anything particularly jump out or any major themes across the board?
Well, it's a real mix, as you'd expect. You've got anticipated literary fiction like Patricia Lockwood's second novel dealing with post-COVID reality, and incredibly, a new Thomas Pynchon novel involving prohibition, conspiracies, and an Austro-Hungarian U-boat under Lake Michigan. Classic Pynchon, right?
Sounds like it. What else?
There's historical depth with Laura Collinsworth's biography of Victoria Whitehall, the equal rights activist and presidential hopeful, and David McCullough's posthumous essays on American character. On the genre front, Owen Jaworowski returns to the Rust Belt setting. McCarran has another Sly House spy thriller. Walter Mosley brings back E.Z. Rollins for his 17th outing. And Richard Osman's Thursday Murder Club returns. Patricia Cornwell also has a new Kay Scarpetta novel. It shows the enduring appeal of series characters.
And some interesting nonfiction, too.
Yeah. Joe Lincoln's Beatmakers focuses on 15 iconic drummers arguing they gave rock its energy. Joaquin Porter's debut novel, If I Survive You, sounds powerful, recounting a relationship during the height of the AIDS crisis in London. And Philip Pullman is concluding his latest Lyra trilogy. Overall, it shows a continued appetite for diverse stories, historical, contemporary, genre, literary grappling with identity, societal change, personal struggle, and just good old-fashioned storytelling. Something for everyone, really. It's a good reminder of the breadth available if you're looking for your next read.
Definitely a lot to look forward to. Now, here's a story about an unexpected literary revival. 2025's oddest hit, five hard-to-find British war novels focusing on Elizabeth Jane Howard's Cazalet Chronicles.
This is a fantastic story about how books find their audience. The core issue is the surprising global resurgence of this series. Long, old-fashioned, hard-to-find, with apparently ugly covers driven purely by word of mouth and social media buzz, readers are becoming evangelists, insisting Howard should be a household name.
Why were they overlooked initially, especially in the U.S.?
Well, Howard wrote them after leaving her husband, Kingsley Amis, who apparently wasn't supportive of her work. While popular in Britain and adapted by the BBC, they were often dismissed critically as domestic trifles, perhaps, as Hilary Mantel suggested, because they were written by a woman and focused on family life during wartime.
But now they're hitting bestseller lists internationally.
Exactly. Huge success in Italy, France, the Netherlands, and now the U.S. seems poised for a Cazalet boom.
Yeah.
It's entirely organic, fueled by readers sharing their passion online. Some speculate it's a post-COVID thing, readers relating to the lockdown-like atmosphere of wartime, but also finding comfort in the simple pleasures of realist, detailed, plentifully peopled historical fiction. It feels like a potential vibe shift towards more immersive ensemble stories.
It's like discovering a hidden gem.
Right. Many readers describe it as rediscovering that childhood feeling of being a voracious reader. It speaks volumes about the power of reader enthusiasm to bypass traditional gatekeepers and the enduring appeal of rich, character-driven storytelling, regardless of when it was written or how it's packaged. It might make you think about what drives your own reading choices.
Moving to another memoir, this one sounds intensely personal. Her large breasts made her life complicated. So did their removal, reviewing Jean Hannah Edelstein's book.
Yes, this sounds like a very raw and honest account. The core issue is Edelstein chronicling her lifelong struggle with having very large breasts, the practical difficulties, the impact on her self-perception and career, and then the intense physical and emotional ordeal of a bilateral mastectomy after a breast cancer diagnosis.
The review mentions specific instances where her body impacted her life.
It does. From the humiliation of a sales assistant's comment, so weird, making her feel her body was only for critique and improvement, to career anxieties about male employers, leading her to switch fields after experiencing blatant sexual harassment at a company party where colleagues dismissed her experience.
And it covers personal life and motherhood, too.
Yes. Meeting her husband, undergoing IVF, the challenges and eventual relief related to breastfeeding, and then the devastating cancer diagnosis at 41. The review highlights the incredible rage she felt on the day of her mastectomy, feeling she wasn't supposed to call life-saving treatment barbaric. It also notes some caustic observations, like criticizing a clinic assistant's Santa hat on diagnosis day.
It sounds like a powerful exploration of body image, societal pressures, and trauma.
Absolutely. It delves into how physical attributes shape a woman's life, the harassment faced professionally, the complexities of motherhood and body autonomy, and the profound trauma of a cancer diagnosis and treatment. It's a deeply personal journey that prompts you to consider the unspoken struggles related to body image, health, and societal expectations that many women endure.
Now, a different kind of journey. Joanna Pocock's Greyhound, reviewed under Through the Bus Windows, Watching America Change. She retraced a cross-country bus trip years later.
Right. This memoir uses the framework of a repeated journey to reflect on societal shifts. Pocock retraced a 2006 bus trip from Detroit to California in 2023, and the core observation is of a country degraded in multiple distressing ways, socially, economically, environmentally.
How did she see this degradation manifest?
A key point is the impact of digital technology. She found it had effectively eradicated the camaraderie she remembered from 2006. Fewer conversations, less generosity among writers, the epification of everything creating isolation. She also critiques the ongoing disassembly of the commons, observing the physical decay and the absurdity of dealing with automated systems, like a hotel operating solely via app with no humans involved.
So it's a critique of technological isolation and economic inequality.
Yes, and environmental decline, the ecocidal madness visible from the bus window. She notes that people without cars who cannot easily move from one place to another are a population who do not matter in the U.S. Yet the review suggests the book isn't entirely hopeless. Her photos apparently betray an affection for American cussed persistence amidst the desolation.
It sounds like a modern take on the road trip narrative.
Exactly. It uses the journey not just for adventure, but for internal reflection and sharp societal critique. It asks you to consider how technology has changed your own interactions and sense of community, and to observe the perhaps subtle but profound shifts happening in the physical and social landscape around you.
Next, a review of what sounds like a very challenging read. Michael Lentz's Schattenfroh, described as a huge hypnotic novel that rewards commitment.
Yes, this one sounds like a serious undertaking. The core issue is navigating this 1,000-page experimental German novel, now in its first English translation. It apparently defies traditional narrative. The narrator is a disembodied figure called Nobody who writes via brain fluid script, mapping his consciousness by floating through memories and scenes, often involving his enigmatic father.
1,000 pages of brain fluid script. What's it actually about?
Well, the review says it's a stream of lengthy digressions, philosophical meditations, religious imagery, linguistic riffs, and personal anguish. Topics range from Rilke and Executioner's Swords to math, nominative determinism, and Plato's Cave. The reviewer suggests it doesn't even require full comprehension, comparing it to hearing the music in Joyce's Ulysses. It has a similarly hypnotic quality that rewards readerly commitment.
So it's about the experience, not just the plot.
Precisely. The reviewer argues that literature like this aims to communicate the otherwise uncommunicable. It's positioned as an antidote to the quick consumption of social media and AI-generated content, offering refreshing immersion rather than escapism. It's framed as a call to dedicate time and effort to something complex and demanding, finding reward in the deep engagement itself. It's an invitation, really, for you, if you're feeling overwhelmed by fleeting digital content, to potentially find profound meaning by committing to a truly unique, challenging literary experience.
Finally, in book world, a less glowing review. R.F. Kuang's Katabasis is a bloated, tedious epic. Sounds like high expectations might not have been met here.
Yes, this review is quite critical. R.F. Kuang has had huge success with Babel and Yellowface, so anticipation for Katabasis was high. But the core critique here is that the novel is bloated, tedious, struggles with narrative rhythm, and feels more invested in the hell of education than its fantastical underworld setting.
What's the basic premise?
The protagonist is Alice Law, an anxious grad student trying to save her late advisor, Professor Grimes, from the underworld, a catabasis, so he can write her a recommendation letter. The setting is a 1980s omni-hell drawing on various mythologies, which the review finds intriguing initially as Alice and a rival try to systematize it. But ultimately, the reviewer feels the story dawdles like a graduation ceremony.
Does the critique focus on the plot or the characters?
It seems to be both. The narrative momentum is reportedly disrupted by backstory dumps. And while Alice's motivation is revealed to be more complex, her advisor was a brute, leaving her traumatized. The university world depicted feels frustratingly small, lacking broader context or rivalries. The reference to Sartre's Hell is Other People is even dismissed as a pat reference when the rival declares hell is a campus.
So it didn't quite land for this reviewer.
Not at all. It serves as a reminder that even acclaimed authors can stumble, especially with ambitious epics. It also raises questions about the potential and limitations of the dark academia genre when it might overshadow the fantastical elements. For you, the listener, it's a reminder that not every hyped book connects, and it's worth considering what elements, pacing, character, depth, world-building truly make a narrative engaging for you.
We're moving into our movies and arts section with a timeless film that's still incredibly relevant today. The enduring, unsettling truth that Rashomon showed us reflects on Akira Kurosawa's 1950 masterpiece, now 75 years old. This film seems to have pioneered the idea of subjective truth in cinema.
Oh, it absolutely did. The core issue here is how Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon pioneered the cinematic representation of subjective truth, becoming a model for truthiness and reflecting a profound cultural shift towards the unreliability of reality. The film's central plot revolves around four contradictory accounts of a samurai's death and his wife's rape, with each witness, the bandit, the wife, the samurai's spirit, and even a woodcutter, offering a drastically different version of events.
This sounds almost prescient for our current media landscape.
It's particularly striking how influential and prescient the film was. While Orson Welles's Citizen Kane, 1941, showed multiple facets of a character, Rashomon offered no such comfort of a final definitive truth. It introduced a new abstraction to movie storytelling, inspiring filmmakers like Federico Fellini and Ingmar Bergman to take more chances with narrative reality. The article argues that the film predicted an era of relative subjectivity, contradictory news, lying heads of state, and a populace divided into opposing armies of reality, concluding, "We live deep inside this movie nowadays."
Beyond its philosophical depth, the film is also praised for its technical brilliance.
Indeed. The film's technological chutzpah and sheer beauty are highlighted, from the long, dappled forest journey and the camera shooting directly into the sun, to the freakiness of the medium scenes and the witty, contrasting acting styles of its cast. This blend of brilliant craftsmanship and ontological provocation is why Rashomon endures.
And Kurosawa's ending offers a flicker of hope amidst this narrative chaos.
This raises important questions about the role of human kindness in the face of profound ambiguity. Kurosawa chose to end the film with the rain letting up and the woodcutter taking in an abandoned baby. While the reviewer calls it sentimental, the director felt it was the only one possible, suggesting that faith in simple human kindness is a prerequisite of civilization, even when truth itself feels elusive. In an age of alternative facts and deep divisions, Rashomon offers a powerful framework for understanding how your perception and others shapes reality. It's a timeless reminder to question, to seek multiple perspectives, and to value empathy in a world where objective truth often feels increasingly out of reach.
Our next story takes us to the vibrant, often raw world of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. The article, "Still Processing the Turbulent Past Decade, So Are These Fringe Shows," suggests artists are using performance to make sense of a chaotic world. This sounds like art at its most urgent.
It absolutely is. The core issue here is how fringe shows at the Edinburgh Festival are serving as a crucial outlet for artists and audiences to process the turbulent past decade, a period marked by organized hate, deadly disease, and war. These performances offer raw, physical, and provocative artistic responses, often using bodies on stage to convey meaning and trauma.
Can you give us some examples of how these artists are tackling such heavy themes?
Well, it's particularly striking how much creativity and emotional depth are on display. Jihada, performed by a Palestinian refugee who grew up in a Beirut camp, uses a horse made of war rubble as a symbol of resilience. The performer uses red-brown masks to portray characters, inviting laughter at the absurdities of life under occupation, only to then deliver the crushing impact of devastation. Then there's Luciano Rosso's Apocalypse Sink, an Argentine physical comedy described as the most vivid and resonant artistic response to the pandemic. Rosso's entire body contorts and vibrates to a soundtrack of COVID lockdowns, transforming the isolation into something surreal, emotional, and alive.
And some shows are even more physically provocative, directly challenging the audience.
This raises important questions about the body as narrative and the power of physical theater. The duo known as Creepy Boys, Sam Kruger and S.E. Grummet, in their punk-styled Slugs, begin in sleeping bag slug costumes, chanting nothing. But once they shed their disguises and provocatively take out their genitals, their bodies become undeniably imbued with meaning, as queer and trans, as vulnerable to gun violence. It's a powerful demonstration that, as the article puts it, whatever story is being told on stage, histories are already written on the body, whether we choose to process them or not. Fringe festivals serve as vital spaces for provocative and boundary-pushing artistic expressions, allowing communities and individuals to collectively metabolize difficult experiences like pandemics, political unrest, and ongoing conflicts. They underscore the essential role of art in societal healing and sense-making,
confronting unsettling truths in ways that traditional narratives often cannot. How do artists help you make sense of a chaotic world? This is a peek into the raw, powerful ways that art confronts the unsettling truths of our time, pushing us to engage with difficult realities and find meaning in shared human experiences.
Now for a more personal dilemma, straight from the advice column. He won't skip annual trip to the island, even though water terrifies his partner, delves into a relationship challenge. Carolyn Hax is known for her no-nonsense advice. What's the core issue here?
Well, the core issue is a common relationship dynamic. How to balance individual fears and joys with a partner's long-standing traditions. The advice seeker, terrified, has a severe fear of water, but her partner, Joe, has an annual family campfire dinner on an island. Terrified, asks if her request for Joe to skip this one night with his family is reasonable.
And Hax's answer is pretty direct, isn't it?
It's particularly striking how unequivocal Hax's, in this one word, no, is. Her rationale is clear. It is not okay to ask people to hand over their joy to your fear. She emphasizes that if a partner chooses to volunteer such a sacrifice entirely on their own, that's different. But a request puts the other person in an impossible spot, forcing them to either grudgingly miss out on something valuable to them or appear callous. Hax credits Joe for his conviction to hold that ground, even if it makes him seem insensitive.
So what advice does she offer to Terrified for managing her own fear and her partner's joy?
This raises important questions about personal growth and managing individual challenges within a partnership. Hax advises Terrified to can read a book or do anything else your imagination offers. She encourages Terrified to plan bravely or joyfully on your terms to reward herself for not pulling Joe from the thing of family legends. Hax warns against issuing an ultimatum, stating that if Terrified uses her misfortune to demand Joe's presence, she becomes bad news for Joe. Her core message is about the importance of respecting a partner's sources of joy and fostering independent coping mechanisms for one's own fears rather than imposing them. It's a call for clear, respectful communication and understanding of boundaries. This relatable dilemma asks how you navigate personal fears in a partner's passions and what it truly means to support someone you love without resorting to coercion. It's a valuable lesson in relationship dynamics and personal autonomy.
A very human dilemma indeed. Moving back to the art world, an exhibition highlighted. Women painters found a room of their own at the Clark Art Institute.
Yes, this exhibition, A Room of Her Own, Women Artist Activists in Britain, 1875-1945, sounds fascinating. The core idea is surveying 25 British women artists from that period, framing them as artist activists. The title, of course, nods to Virginia Woolf's essay, and the first work shown is the dust jacket for it, designed by her sister, Vanessa Bell.
How are they artist activists?
The exhibition argues they became activists simply by eking out the necessary room to become professional artists in a society that pressured them towards marriage. They challenged norms and created spaces for themselves and others to thrive. Examples include Anna Hope, Nan Hudson, and Ethel Sands creating a refuge in Normandy, or Gwen John painting her simple tea set after clearing breakfast, a quiet but political act of claiming space for her art.
And the exhibition shows their work moving beyond the domestic sphere.
Exactly. It culminates with large-scale works pushing into the public realm, like Anna Airy becoming the first official woman war artist, commissioned to paint factory scenes during WWI. The war itself liberated many women from conventions, though the devastation of WWII also brought tragedy, like the destruction of Wolf's homes shortly before her death.
It sounds like a powerful look at gender, creativity, and social change.
Definitely. It highlights the historical struggles women faced for recognition and space in the arts, how art reflects and contributes to societal shifts like women's rights, and the enduring legacy of figures like Wolf. It's a vibrant look at how these women shaped their own destiny and redefined art, asking you to consider the silent struggles that paved the way for current freedoms.
Our final item in the cultural deep dive is a curious one. What was the song of the summer? You'll never, ever guess the correct answer. It seems 2025 didn't have a clear, unifying song of the summer.
It's a fascinating cultural indicator. The core issue is that 2025 lacked a clear song of the summer due to a gloomy social climate, increased isolation, and algorithmic music consumption. Unlike 2024, which had multiple contenders like Sabrina Carpenter's Espresso and Charlie XCX's Brat album, this summer seemed to bypass that collective celebratory mood.
So why the absence of a clear hit? What does it say about our current social climate?
Well, it's particularly striking how popular music reflects broader societal moods.
the article points to a slump in champagne sales and an antisocial turn in post-pandemic America, with people spending more time at home and less time together. Gen Z is reportedly partying less, pulling back on drinking and clubbing, and the U.S. is even facing a tourism decline. These aren't ideal conditions for infectious, dance floor magnetizing summer jams. The world that may not inspire fits of collective celebration is directly referenced, tying back to the front page stories we've discussed.
But there was an unexpected candidate that filled the void in a very particular way.
This raises important questions about the power of digital culture and memes. The unlikely song of the summer candidate was a broken fragment of a song, repurposed for an advertisement and co-opted into a meme. Jess Glynn's Hold My Hand, used in a Jet 2 holiday ad. What started as an upbeat commercial jingle, nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday and right now you can save 50 pounds per person, was grabbed by 3.1 million TikTok users to soundtrack videos of vacation activities gone horribly virally wrong. Think bad hotel views, parasailers dragged, or water slide disasters.
So the song became associated with spectacular failure.
Exactly. People love watching things go wrong spectacularly, and Glynn's voice became a Pavlovian signal for disaster. Billboard's charts, meanwhile, showed Morgan Wallen dominating for the third straight year, indicating how algorithmic and niche music consumption has become, fragmenting mainstream culture. The subtext of Glynn's viral use, the article suggests, is a relentless insistence that summer fun, for the time being, is off the table. They even called it Drat Summer. What was your personal song of the summer, and does this reflect a broader shift away from shared cultural experiences? This story offers a thought-provoking look at the soundtrack of our times and how digital culture can reshape our relationship with music and collective mood.
We're wrapping up our deep dive with a look into the vibrant worlds of travel and sports. First up, some practical advice combined with deep cultural tradition. We have 8 essential tips for planning a college football road trip alongside the HBCU football weekend that's like a family reunion in New Orleans.
Yes. These pieces together capture something really special about American sports culture. The first one, based on Roger Sherman's experience hitting 62 games in a season, offers practical tips for navigating college towns. Key takeaways. Get everywhere early. Hotel prices are astronomical. Cheaper to get a room in Paris than the third worst hotel in an SEC town. Driving is usually necessary. Traffic is insane. God of gridlock. Tailgate food is the best. Bring beer to trade. Plan bathroom breaks strategically, but fans are generally very hospitable, even to rivals.
That paints a picture. And then there's the Bayou Classic piece.
Right, and that shifts focus to the profound cultural significance. The core issue is highlighting this annual Southern versus Grambling State rivalry as much more than a game. It's an HBCU family reunion. It's a multi-generational tradition encompassing the Battle of the Bands, often the main event, step shows, the game, halftime, royal courts. People like Chadrick Kennedy, born during the first Superdome game, plan their lives around it.
It sounds like a cornerstone of community identity.
Absolutely. It reinforces roots, fosters connections, and provides a unique cultural experience. The article mentions the Andrews family, 4 generations of Southern Jaguars fans, and Ronnie Griffin, inspired to attend Grambling by the band and fraternity life he saw at the Classic. The food, the friendly rivalry, win Bayou Classic, even if the season's bad. It all speaks to the vital role of HBCUs and these traditions in celebrating heritage and community. Whether you're navigating the logistical chaos of a Big Ten town or soaking in the generation's deep traditions of the Bayou Classic, these stories highlight how deeply ingrained sports are in American culture, community, and personal identity.
Great context. Let's look at some game results now. Washington delivers a strong first impression, covers the Maryland Terrapins opener.
Yes, a dominant start for the Terps, beating FAU 39-7. The big story is true freshman quarterback Washington. He set program records for completions and yards by a true freshman in a debut, throwing for 258 yards and 3 TDs with no interceptions. That's impressive, the first true frosh to throw 3 TDs in a debut for a power conference team since Trevor Lawrence in 2018.
So he lived up to the hype immediately.
After a slightly slow start, yeah, he was rolling. It continues Maryland's streak of 14 straight non-conference opening wins. And the defense looks strong, too, with junior linebacker Daniel Wingate getting 10 tackles and a pick six. A really solid team performance to kick off the season.
On the flip side, a tougher start for another highly touted QB. For Manning, a tough way to start, discusses Arch Manning in Texas.
Right. The pressure on him is just immense coming from the Manning royal family. Number one, Texas lost a tight one, 14-7, to number 3, Ohio State. Manning's performance was described as uneven. He went 17 for 30 for 170 yards, 1 TD, but also a crucial interception in the third quarter.
How did he handle it?
He took responsibility, saying, "I thought we'd beat ourselves a lot, and that starts with me." He acknowledged needing to play better. It was a huge test defending national champs, massive hostile crowd, and Ohio State's new coordinator, Matt Patricia, throwing complex coverages at him. Coach Sarkisian saw flashes and glimpses and emphasized growth, saying, "We're going to be fine." It highlights the intense pressure and the steep learning curve, even for someone with that pedigree.
Next, another high-profile coach, Deion Sanders. After Scare, Sanders is still primed to be himself. How did Colorado look?
Well, they lost their opener 27-20 to Georgia Tech. But the story focuses more on Coach Prime himself. After an offseason dealing with change, losing his sons and Travis Hunter from the team, plus his own cancer scare that resulted in losing his bladder, he was back with his characteristic swagger.
Mm-hmm.
Jogging onto the field, sunglasses on, gold chain dangling. The article notes the presence of a portable toilet near the bench underscored the challenge, but portrays him as a survivor, running for the cameras when he's at his most vulnerable. It's about his resilience and public persona as much as the game result.
A quick look at soccer. United finally halts free fall in New York. A much-needed win for DC United.
Yes, a rare bright spot for them. They snapped an 11-game winless streak, beating NYCFC 2-1. Gabriel Pirani scored both goals. It's their first win since May 31st. Doesn't change the fact they were the first team eliminated from playoff contention with the league's worst goal differential, but still, a win's a win, right? It broke NYCFC's own unbeaten streak, too.
Absolutely. Now a huge upset. In a stunner, Seminoles roll past Crimson Tide, Florida State over Alabama.
This is a big one. FSU as 13-12-point underdogs beat Notham. Alabama 31-17, ending the Tide's 23-game season-opening win streak. FSU's new QB, Tommy Castellanos, led a strong rushing attack, and their defense really stepped up, holding Bama on third and fourth downs. Alabama QB Ty Simpson had decent stats in his debut, but it wasn't enough. This will definitely shake up the rankings and gives FSU a massive boost.
Another dominant opener. Mids hit the ground running with a season-opening rout. Navy looks strong.
Very strong. They beat VMI 52-7, their most points in an opener since 2016. Their option offense, which led to a 10-win season last year, looked sharp. Braxton Woodson rushed for 180 yards and two TDs. The defense, despite six new starters, had five sacks and mostly shut down VMI, aside from one long TD pass, which the coach called sloppy. They definitely look like a team building on success.
Hopping over to tennis. Goff and Osaka set up fourth-round showdown at the U.S. Open. Sounds like Goff played well.
Yes, described as her most solid and stress-free match so far. She beat Magdalena Fresh 6-3, 6-1. The big focus is her serve. After struggling badly with double faults recently, she looked much better, only four doubles, 76% first serves. Didn't get broken early like in previous rounds. Seems the work with biomechanics expert Gavin McMillan might be paying off. Now she faces Naomi Osaka, which would be a great match.
Switching to baseball, not such good news for the local team. Bad to worse, Nats dropped seven straight, placed Mackenzie Gore on IL.
Yeah, tough stretch for the Nationals. They lost 4-1 to the Rays, their seventh straight loss, dropping them to 53-82. And compounding things, all-star pitcher Mackenzie Gore hit the 15-day IL with shoulder inflammation. He was great in the first half, but has struggled since the break. This is his third IL stint, though he believes this one isn't as serious. Offense continues to struggle too, going 2-for-9 with runners in scoring position.
Oof. And in the WNBA, expansion Golden State puts a beating on Mystics.
Another tough one for DC. The expansion Golden State Valkyries routed the Mystics 99-62. Carla Late had 19 points off the bench for Golden State, who shot 55% overall. It was the Mystics' sixth straight loss. Shows the strength of the new expansion teams making an impact.
Finally, some local high school football action. Falcons defensive line sets tone for new season, covers Good Counsel's win.
Yes, Good Counsel, ranked number 2 locally, opened with a solid 14-7 win over a Florida power, Columbus. The story highlights their dominant defensive line as the cornerstone of the team, giving Columbus fits all evening. They didn't allow an offensive touchdown. A freshman running back scored the winning TD. Looks like they're ready for a competitive WCC season. #outro. Wow, okay, what a deep dive today. We've certainly seen a world in constant flux, from the push and pull of federal power reshaping everything from trade to public health, to the devastating human cost of global conflicts and the ripple effects of economic policy on everyday lives. We've explored how a city balances federal intervention with local autonomy, and even found unexpected heroes in a Batman onesie. It's truly fascinating how seemingly disparate stories from the news often reflect deeper, interconnected forces shaping our world. Whether it's the ethical dilemmas of AI, the enduring need for human connection, or the resilience found in challenging traditional narratives.
As always, thank you for guiding us through this labyrinth of information. Today's deep dive into the Washington Post shows us a world in constant flux, where the lines between governance and personal freedom, between science and politics, and even between reality and perception are constantly being redrawn. It reminds us that being truly well-informed isn't just about consuming facts, but about actively questioning, connecting, and understanding the why behind the what. So, as you go about your week, consider, in what area of your life or in what aspect of the world are you willing to challenge an established narrative or look for the hidden story that truly impacts us all? From Sam and me, thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. Until next time, keep exploring.